This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, The Tragedy of Syria. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. About 7 years ago, inspired by democratic uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, Syrians took to the streets to protest political repression by the autocratic regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Slogans like peaceful, peaceful, and efforts to broker a political compromise with Bashar al-Assad were met with regime recalcitrance and violence. This prompted many Syrian soldiers to defect and form what came to be known as the Free Syria Army, which found support and refuge in neighboring Turkey. Other civil society groups battling the depredations of the Syrian regime emerged. The so-called Friends of Syria, an international diplomatic collective of countries and bodies created in response to Russian and Chinese vetoes on Security Council resolutions condemning Syria, recognized the Syrian National Council as a legitimate representative of the Syrian people. But valiant efforts by Syrian civilians, the Free Syria Army, and the many grassroots civil society groups, including the White Helmets, were no match in the end for the political will, determination, and sheer force of the Bashar al-Assad regime and its allies, Iran and Hezbollah. In 2012, after his re-election, U.S. President Barack Obama was laser-focused on securing a nuclear deal with Iran and ignored policy recommendations from his cabinet-level officials to provide significant military assistance to the Syrian opposition when they may have stood a chance to defeat or severely weaken Bashar al-Assad. Half-hearted attempts by the Pentagon to train the Syrian opposition ultimately failed. When Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons in 2013, which President Obama at one time said would be a red line that would be met with military strikes against the regime, military strikes which never materialized, Bashar al-Assad knew that the United States and its Western allies had no appetite for a real confrontation. Instead, Washington welcomed a deal to secure and rid Syria of its chemical weapons brokered by Russia. Meantime, Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia stepped into the breach to militarily support various factions of the Syrian opposition, some of which became radicalized and even affiliated themselves with local al-Qaeda branches. In 2015, Moscow entered the Syrian conflict to bolster Bashar al-Assad's flagging forces, turning the tide of the war in favor of Assad. The United States under Barack Obama and now under President Donald Trump has been more focused on defeating the so-called Islamic State in Syria than supporting what was left of the beleaguered Syrian opposition and the civilian population. So what started as a genuine and peaceful uprising against the autocratic Assad dynasty has morphed into a proxy war between Assad's allies, Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia on the one hand, and Saudi Arabia and its allies on the other. But even that binary description is inaccurate today. Turkey, once a staunch critic of the Assad regime and its backers, launched its olive branch operation in late January 2018 to drive the Kurdish YPG militia out of a key border area. Ankara makes little distinction between Syrian Kurds and Kurdish separatists in Turkey that it considers terrorists. The problem is that those very Syrian Kurdish militias have been staunch allies of the United States in fighting the so-called Islamic State in Syria. Meantime, about 13.1 million people are in need of protection and humanitarian assistance, including 6.1 million who are internally displaced. 5.5 million Syrians are refugees, and the United Nations is seeking $3.5 billion to assist 13 million people inside Syria this year. Well, with us to discuss the status of this festering Syrian conflict and the way forward are two of the best Syria analysts in the country. Faisal Itani is senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank based in Washington. And Charles Lister is a scholar and Syria expert at the Middle East Institute, a policy group also based in Washington. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program. Charles Lister, let me begin with you. What is the state of play and the players in Syria, and how do you think former President Obama's inaction, in a sense, sort of set the table for what we're seeing today and the Trump administration, in a sense, almost continuing the same type of policy?
Yeah, well, Syria is in as bad a position, I think, now as it really ever has been. I think we're in a situation now in early 2018 whereby a lot of the root causes of the conflict are re-erupting. A lot of those root causes, the conflict between the regime and the opposition, tensions between Turkey and Kurdish separatists, a lot of those root causes were pushed aside whilst the fight against ISIS was prioritised by much of the international community. Now that that fight has begun to recede, it's certainly not over, but now that it's receding, a lot of those root causes are coming right back out into the open, and all of the main players in Syria and outside Syria are trying to redefine what the trajectory of the future of the conflict is, or what the future of Syria is. And that's why we've seen Turkey intervening in northern Syria. That's why we've seen recent regime attack on American troops in eastern Syria. That's why we've seen Russia pivoting things to Sochi and launching a new political process. So we've seen a lot of new developments in the last 2 to 3 months because of that new dynamic. What does it mean about US policy in the past and now in the future? US policy pre-ISIS in 2014, US policy on Syria was basically a policy of containment. The idea was, you know, we see Syria as a concern, but it's not a significant enough interest to get wholeheartedly involved. The rise of ISIS created a reason for us to get involved, but only to counter ISIS. And in that sense, we pushed aside the rest of the root causes of the conflict. ISIS is a symptom, not a root cause. And really, that's what we've seen since. The Trump administration is still primarily concerned with fighting terrorism, primarily still ISIS. It says it has many other grand objectives in Syria in terms of securing a political transition, making sure refugees and IDPs can come back to their homes, removing Syria of weapons of mass destruction. But frankly speaking, A, we haven't seen a strategy in order to actually secure those objectives, and B, we have no way near the means available on the ground or the political will at home to actually do what it takes to secure those objectives. So we're still in this weird position of having these very good, laudable objectives, but there's no foreseeable path in which we're actually going to achieve them. So basically that means, from a policy standpoint, we're still in this state of stagnation and confusion. The international community doesn't quite know what we stand for and what we really want to do, and the regime and its various allies think, therefore, that they can take advantage of our own ambiguity, and they will continue to try to take advantage of that kind of confusion.
Turning to you, Faisal Itani, picking up on what Charles Lister said about the regime capitalizing or taking advantage of what appears to be ambiguity with respect to U.S. policy, how do you see the regime and its ally situation? Do they have the upper hand, would you say, particularly Russia and Iran? Every day we're seeing airstrikes by Russia killing civilians on the pretext that they're, you know, fighting terrorists. We're hearing this over and over again, and Syrians are absolutely at wit's end. It's as if everyone, the world has forgotten them.
You know, this thing really turned around when the Russians came into the country, not because they have an incredibly sophisticated military capacity, but because A, it made it riskier for the United States to get involved, and B, they had a strategy of collective punishment, essentially, against the population that made the opposition, the armed opposition, have to seek out compromises with the regime. Now, we believed, or we convinced ourselves, that because we thought Syria wasn't worth it, we thought it was a complicated conflict, we thought things could not be solved purely by force, that the Russians would fail. They didn't fail. If their objective was to create a shining example of prosperity and democracy, then they failed. But if their objective was to make sure Bashar al-Assad stayed in Damascus, he has stayed in Damascus. They're struggling to turn it into a diplomatic victory. Fine. The Iranians are stronger than they've ever been in Syria, literally stronger than they've ever been. And the assets we have on the ground in Western Syria, or useful Syria, the part where the population is and the resources are and the infrastructure is, we don't have many left anymore because we lost most of the opposition. That was basically the most likely and promising way to put pressure on the regime short of an actual invasion of the country. So they're not there anymore. And for us to kind of recoup our investments and get a leg up and get back into the conflict and have a stake in it, it's become much more costly and risky than it would have been a couple of years ago.
Well, turning back to you, Charles Lister, you insinuated that it was a mistake for the United States to concentrate almost exclusively on ridding Syria of the so-called Islamic State, which is certainly an enormous threat, which emerged in 2014 with respect to Iraq. But at the same time, we find ourselves, like you said, back to the beginning with the root causes coming out again. So how do you see going forward, and what is left of the moderate opposition to whom Faisal alluded? Have we just simply abandoned them? Have they been radicalized?
Sure. Well, just to go back to the beginning of your question, I mean, the United States was right, obviously, to focus on ISIS in the sense that we did. ISIS was a very dramatic threat to regional stability, and then it has since become a threat to international stability. And we were right to try to deal with that. The problem is, though, is that the way we framed that fight was it was solely about a fight against terrorism. And we kind of forgot the fact that the root causes of the conflict, the regime's extraordinary suppression of its own population, the various means with which it uses violence and war crimes against its population. That was the reason why groups like ISIS emerged. It's also the reason why we've seen huge refugee flows that have crippled Syria's neighbours and destabilised Europe. It's also the reason why we've seen the normalisation of chemical warfare now. There's been over 320 chemical weapon attacks in Syria since 2012, 98% of which were by the regime. And, you know, I can list all of the other consequences, but they are consequences, not causes. So long as we continue to try and deal with consequences, we're never going to solve the conflict. It's not going to happen. In terms of your question about the moderate opposition, you know, the United States had put itself in a position from late 2012 until last summer, whereby we had, with cooperation with regional allies, at least 60,000 fighters under our command or control or influence. The conventional wisdom has always been to accuse the United States of having failed to acquire relationships on the ground. And the always example used for that is the Department of Defense's attempt to establish a train and equip mission with the armed opposition, which was a catastrophic failure. But that was trying to fight ISIS. The CIA, with US government permission and funding, had pursued its own program since the end of 2012, which had fostered over 80 armed groups across the country with over 60,000 fighters. And yes, over time, they were beginning to change nature. Yes, they were put into positions whereby they had to cooperate with other groups that we weren't very happy with. But they were, in plain speak, a tool that we could be using on the ground for our own policy purposes. The problem was, of course, that last summer, the Trump administration cut all assistance to every single one of those fighters. All of their salaries stopped being paid in January this year. They stopped receiving weapons last fall. And the consequence of that is we have literally now no leverage over the armed opposition in Syria. Zero. Why? Because they look at us as someone who betrayed their cause and simply doesn't care about the fact that they're being violently suppressed by their own government. And that has placed them into a position of genuinely being direct proxies for now regional states who are pursuing their own immediate national security interests, which is why Turkey's doing what it is now and Saudi Arabia and others. But the core question from a US policy standpoint is we gave up our leverage by making that decision. And that directly abetted regime survival, Iran's continued expansionism, more civilian displacement. And that's on the Trump administration. Whether they meant for that to happen or not, it was a decision they made, and that has been the consequence. And we now have to try and deal with that.
Well, that's a very good point that Charles makes, a very interesting distinction with respect to how the United States was, in fact, helping via the CIA these groups. Faisal Itani, talk about why you think the Trump administration cut that assistance and what the consequences are. And what's ironic is that the consequences actually undermine the stated objectives of the Trump administration in Syria, it seems.
I'll get to the objectives in a minute. I think they did it because they gave up on the idea of military pressure on Damascus using proxy forces. And they gave up on the idea that this would end the conflict or sway the balance positively in the United States' direction. Whether or not they caused the series of events that followed, I think that's part of it, certainly. But the irony is, and the confusing thing is, at the same time as they did that, officially they'd gone a much more belligerent position against the Assad regime than President Obama did, even though it was under his watch these armies were created. So now we have a more belligerent position in which we want to weaken Iran, we want to get Assad out of power, etc. But we don't have that proxy militant tool anymore.
So there's a discrepancy between ends and means.
Yeah, a severe one. I think once you say you want to get Bashar al-Assad out of power and you want to weaken Iran and Syria when both of them are stronger than they've ever been since 2011, then it begs the question, okay, how are you going to do it without these kind of proxy instruments? I could probably take a guess as to some of the other things they have in mind, but they haven't clarified exactly what they think will get them from point A to point B.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Faisal Itani, he's senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center at the Atlantic Council, and Charles Lister, he's scholar and Syria expert at the Middle East Institute, a policy group also based in Washington. And we're discussing the conflict in Syria and the way forward. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to Twitter follower and loyal listener Abdullah Ghaznawi from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'll back to our special guest talking about Syria and turning now to Charles Lister. Well, Charles, what do you make of the United Nations so-called peace process or the recent, you know, gathering in Sochi where even the opposition and the Kurds didn't even attend? I mean, are these just kabuki theater?
Well, they're theater now, but that were based on, I think, very legitimate original foundations. The UN process is still technically speaking based on the original Geneva communique of 2012 and also on subsequent UN Security Council resolutions that lay out the need for a political process that leads to a political transition in Damascus, i.e. Assad's departure. The problem is, of course, is that we have seen this pattern play out every single year since 2012, in which the regime attends these talks, plays along until the end, and then says, but no, we're not negotiating over our own transition. We're leaving now. And then 2 or 3 months later, the UN tries again, and we see the same game play out. And we've seen that since 2012. So, you know, Faisal mentioned earlier the Russian intervention changing things, and it definitely changed things militarily on the ground. I think we've seen that methodically since late 2015. But Russia has basically won as many battles on the ground as I think it can now on the strategic level, which is why we've seen them pivot towards the political process and trying to launch their own political process. Their attempt in Sochi was something different than what the United Nations has done. They embraced a kind of Western concept known as a national dialogue, in which they wanted to bring 1,600 Syrians from all sectors of society, from all political perspectives, and bring them together within a dialogue to agree on certain fundamental principles about what Syria is and what Syria's future will be. Now, we had problems from the very start because the main opposition blocs boycotted the talks, because the regime flag was being used as the official platform for the whole dialogue. So there's the fundamental question here about what does Russia actually want? Russia does want stability in Syria, but it wants it on its terms and on the regime's terms. And from day one, that's going to be unacceptable to the opposition. And interestingly, it was unacceptable to the main Kurdish blocs under the PYD, which is our main ally fighting ISIS. The fact that they didn't go and the fact that they still veto or disagree with the consequences from Sochi means, in my opinion at least, the consequences from Sochi are meaningless. Whatever Russia wants to trumpet about it being a victory, I actually think it was a kind of catastrophic defeat for Russia. And I think Russia, broadly speaking, is also under a lot of pressure to try and capitalize on its military gains because it's also aware that it faces a disadvantage on the battlefield in the sense that Iran plays many, many, many more cards on the ground than Russia does. And in a sense, we've seen this kind of parallel race. Iran is trying to determine the dynamics on the battlefield to shape the political future. Russia has shaped the military dynamics up until now and is therefore trying to use that to shape the political trajectory now. But it's suffering. It's struggling to do that. So, yes, they're on the same side, Iran and Russia, but they're beginning to come towards slightly divergent positions. Russia wants a political solution as soon as possible. Iran will be happy for no political solution for another 10 years because it has much more to gain from continued violence in Syria.
Turning back to you, Faisal, for your take on the role of the United Nations as well as the recent Sochi and anything to add or subtract to what Charles Lister said, especially with respect to Iran, because even if Russia failed in this recent Sochi gathering, Iran, according to Charles, can go forward, keep fighting. What does Iran want? And again, what are the implications for Syria in terms of keeping it together, if that's even possible, and getting rid of Bashar al-Assad? Or would Iran never tolerate that?
Let me start at the beginning with the UN process. Of course, it's based on the idea of a negotiated transition in Syria based on mutual consent. And yes, that's very nice. We all agree with that. Having said that, the idea that from a position of military weakness, the opposition can get a fair deal from Bashar al-Assad is ridiculous. And therefore, continuing with the UN process as if the military situation is still either stalemated or up in the air or whatever is ridiculous. Bashar al-Assad is not going to negotiate his political monopoly from a position of strength. He's killed 500,000 people to make sure he doesn't have to do that. And he's not going to do it because there's a UN process. Now, the Russian element does make things a bit more interesting. Because for the Russians, this is kind of a, you know, it's a war of choice at the end of the day. They didn't have to come into Syria. They can live without Bashar al-Assad. But they chose to do it because they wanted very particular gains from it. And one of the main gains was international respectability, playing things off like a great power, the ability to shape events on the ground through both military force and also more kind of respectable, legitimate, gentlemanly ways, such as these processes in Sochi. Now, their problem is the war part is easy because there's no one on the other side that has that kind of firepower. But their problem is convincing Bashar al-Assad to even temporarily accept something less than complete reconquest of the country is very difficult. It's difficult for the same reasons that even in 2011, when he was in control of the country, he refused to have any serious conversations with anybody there. He sees his rule over Syria as completely indivisible, and that if you think otherwise, you're either a fool or you're an enemy. And you have to be fought till you're convinced otherwise or you're dead. So the reason why this charade can keep on going is because of Iran. Because this gap between Syrian regime and Russian priorities can be filled by the Iranians perpetually. The Iranians can keep giving Bashar al-Assad what he needs to fight his war, or their war, as it happens right now. They are not going anywhere. This is their backyard. They're not really taking a lot of losses. It's mostly Syrians that are dying on their behalf, and Afghanis and Iraqis. So their time frame is long. At the end of the day, what they want to see is a Syria in their orbit, and a Lebanon, and an Iraq. And they're almost there.
Well, as we close, back to you, Charles Lister. To what extent has Turkey's so-called Operation Olive Branch, which began in late January to curtail Kurdish influence, the very Kurds with whom the United States has an alliance against Islamic State, to what extent is that complicating the situation even further?
Short answer is this was totally predictable. The U.S. counter-ISIS policy was driven by the need for short-term tactical gains, but we knew we were backing a party that was perceived as an existential security threat in Turkey. It's no surprise that Turkey waited for the right opportunity to pursue what it sees as its own national security interests, which is to block or to weaken that threat. And that will continue so long as some kind of broader arrangement or broader deal is made that sees the Turks and the Kurds come to some kind of a detente. Maybe not a ceasefire, maybe not a deal, but they at very least need to agree not to be fighting each other. But plainly speaking, the US counter-ISIS policy backed an organization that our very own government in the United States labeled a terrorist organization until the day that we started working with them. And the consequences of that is very clear, and we'll continue to have to try to deal with it in a tactical sense until we decide that the only solution to it is on the strategic, bigger level. But that means big diplomatic efforts. That means having to incorporate things that are much beyond the counter-ISIS fight, much beyond northern Syria. But I don't see any sign of that yet.
Well, Faisal Aktani, you get the last word, Turkish involvement.
It just goes to show you, right? I mean, we chose a path against ISIS, for better or worse. It was based on tactical military considerations. And we chose the YPG to Turkey. The analogy I like to use is like us allying with Hezbollah on the Israeli border against Al-Qaeda. That's exactly the analogy, whether or not you like the militias in question or not.
I don't think Israel would like that.
That's fine. I mean, and what would you expect from them? But the funny thing about us is not only are we opposed to what the Turks are doing, which is fine, okay, but we don't really quite understand how on earth this happened and why it came about. Whereas just even a little bit of analysis and empathy will show you that's what we would have done too, and any other nation would have done it. Just going to show you we have no friends in Syria anymore. Every single state actor in Syria hates us or resents us, whether it's Turkey, Russia, Iran, or anybody else. The least we could do is get the Turks back.
I'm afraid on that dubious note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I can assure you we will revisit Syria in the coming weeks. I'd like to thank my guests, Faisal Aktani, Senior Fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center at the Atlantic Council, and Charles Lister, Scholar and Syria Expert at the Middle East Institute. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your terrific analysis.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.